You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? This is the Talking Tactics Podcast. My name's Daniel.
I'm Colin.
We do the podcast every Tuesday. At least we record it then. You guys may be here at Wednesday. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all at Talking Tactics. I'm at Daniel Taluk. Carl, where can people find you if you want to be found?
You can find my writing over on The Athletic.
Indeed, Have Hope is at halfhopefootballhut.com. I don't know where he is. You know what? I wouldn't be surprised if he's gone to watch Flowers, Killers of the Flower Moon. I wouldn't be surprised. Is that the name of the film?
Killers of the Flower Moon. Yep.
Killers of the Flower Moon. Yeah. I think the next movie I'm going to watch is Napoleon. I don't know where.
I'm very excited for Napoleon as well.
But that's the next. I don't know if I want to watch that movie, Killers of the Flower Moon. It looks kind of.
It's tremendous. It's tremendous, my friend. I really think you should watch it.
Right. Any announcements that we have? Do you have anything coming out, like a piece that people should know about?
So we are talking on Tuesday. My next piece will probably come out on Thursday, and it'll be about Ajax. And I'll be off to Manchester United versus Fulham on Saturday, and I'll also be at Copenhagen versus Ajax. So I'll be in Denmark next week.
I watched the PSV game. Very bad.
Wow. Yeah. I'm watching the highlights again now for the piece I'm writing.
I'm writing down things that we should talk about. So I need to put that down. Announcements. We are releasing another Talking Tactics documentary. This one is one that meant a lot to me. It was a labor of love. It should have been released on a different platform, but that fell through in a very nasty way. At least to me, I don't think they even think about it. But it's going to be called Written in the Stars, and it's going to be about Chelsea's 2012 Champions League victory. We've got some fun guests. Carl would know Nick Miller. He would
Nick
know
Nick Miller's amazing.
Rowan West Henry.
Yep.
Obviously, Have Hope's there. I got Toby Eilshaffel. I'm going to kill that guy's name. He's like Sport Builds Bayern guy. Mark Worrell's on it. Nini FC, who's been on this podcast many times.
Nini's great.
He's on it. So, yeah. And like a lot of them were in the stadium at the time for the final.
Wow.
So, yeah. It's a good one. It's a good one. If I do say so myself, even as somebody who made it. So that's going to drop November 20. So, yeah, that's something to look forward to. I'll plug it every week until it drops. So look forward to you guys hearing it. Where's the place to start? I'm sure it's something I have written down you'll say, but where do you want to start?
Can we start with the Ballon d'Or?
I didn't watch. Did you watch?
No, I didn't watch. I'm just looking at the results now as the post in front of me. I haven't been on the podcast in a while because Manchester United keep me very, very busy. But I thought, Have Hope will have some very, very strong opinions on the Ballon d'Or list. So let me pop in and hear what he says. And lo and behold, Have Hope has so many opinions on it that he's actually had to go take a lie down.
You know what? Yeah, I was going to say part of the reason he's not here is because I think he did a 3-hour live stream last night into the early morning about the Ballon d'Or on his channel, debating Messi's greatness and all of that. So shout out to HH. But yeah, I don't care. I haven't cared in so long. I always had a problem with the format, that it was a calendar year instead of a season. Yep. Now it's become more of a season, but still, it doesn't quite add up. So Messi's season was worthy of the Ballon d'Or, or was it just because the World Cup happened in the season?
I think Ballon d'Ors in World Cup years are very different from Ballon d'Ors in a conventional European football season. There's also the argument that I think when you said it was about a calendar year, that kind of helped if you weren't playing in Europe. Although over the years, obviously more and more talent gravitated towards Europe. So therefore it became more of a competition about the European calendar. I found it very funny that the MLS was, congratulations to Lionel Messi, the first MLS player to win the Ballon d'Or. I was like, aww, you enjoy that. You sure did, MLS. Well done. Good for you.
What did he win? He won a league pass? What did he win?
He won the League's Cup.
Oh.
Which is one of the domestic cup competitions in North American football.
Hold on.
It was a competition that I didn't know existed until Messi won it, which League shows
cup, founded 2019.
Yeah.
We don't respect this thing.
Who's we?
Me.
Okay.
But just more me's.
I didn't know it existed, and I remember tweeting after Messi won it saying, one thing about the Messi effect in America is I've got a greater appreciation for the non-MLS competitions now, because everyone, you know, ESPN has been talking about Messi. So I'm like, oh, that's what that competition is, and that gives you qualifications to this one and this one and this one. So, and I will say I did used to care about the Ballon d'Or a little bit. You know, when it was the FIFA Ballon d'Or, so that little time period where the FIFA Best Award merged with the Ballon d'Or, I cared about it a lot. But also now, as my knees start clicking more, my hair goes gray, and I've seen the same argument over and over and over and over and over and over again. I've got gray hair.
Wow!
My temples are graying, and I've got gray hair in my beard.
What stress were you in as a child? Don't answer.
There you go. So,
I can't wait to go great.
But now I've reached this age. I was saying this to someone who, so I went, oh, congrats to Messi. And then someone like jumped in my Instagram DMs going, I think this year is a bit of a farce. And I went, mate, I don't care. I said, I treat the Ballon d'Or like I treat the Employee of the Month award, in that it's nice when someone I like wins it, but if someone I don't really care about wins it, whatever.
The only thing I was excited to see when I went to send the link just now, and I went through, I typed in Ballon d'Or just to see if there was anything interesting that happened. And apparently Hazard gave an award to Jude Bellingham, and then Drogba and Hazard linked up for maybe the last time. Who knows? I don't know. I hope that's a bit morbid. For like something to make Chelsea fans happy, to just tickle some nostalgia of Drogba and Hazard together again. So that was nice to see. At least in
picture form. Enjoyed how calm and relaxed Hazard was at the award as well. They asked him if he missed playing football. He goes, no, not really. He goes, it's only been a month, but when I start missing football, I'll be worried. But for now, I'm just enjoying being at home with my kids. And they said, well, he said, I'm only really here because my kids asked me to. So he's chill. He's enjoying life. So Lionel Messi won Ballon d'Or. Haaland came second. Mbappe came fourth, I want to say. Let me actually get this thing up before I make a fool of myself.
I know he was fourth in 2018.
There we go.
I remember
Mbappe
that.
Mbappe came third. Sorry.
Mm.
So Messi won. That's his eighth Ballon d'Or. He has three more than the closest Ballon d'Or winner, which is Cristiano Ronaldo with five. Haaland won the award for the best striker. And Jude Bellingham won the Copper Award, which is the award for the best young player. Alicia Bonmati won the Women's Ballon d'Or, the Barcelona and Spain midfielder.
She's cold.
She's cold. Just next level good.
Like she's really good at the World Cup. Okay, that's Carl, I don't care about the Ballon d'Or. I don't care. Let's talk about what you're talking about. Let's use the Ballon d'Or, though, that thing you just mentioned. What is it, Copa Award?
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about Jude Bellingham. That's more fun.
Yeah.
So, like everyone who watches football and cares about world football, I woke up quite early on Saturday, I think, so I could catch all the coverage. Game kicked off at like 10. Actually, Chelsea played, didn't they? Chelsea must have played on Saturday morning.
Look at you pretending that they didn't play.
I watched that. That was really bad. And then it was Brentford. They lost to Brentford 2-0. It's all coming back to me. So I was like, let's watch real football now. So let's turn on El Clasico. So that's what we did. Gundogan scored in the first 6-7 minutes. Real Madrid didn't look great, really.
Mm.
And then second half, Jude Bellingham does what he's done all season, which is kind of not score goals from nowhere, because they're not from nowhere, but just pops up with timely moments. And he did it. He scored the equalizer, great finish, power strike. I don't know how you would say. And I think, what's it? Injury time. A ball gets looped into Modric. Modric somehow touches it. I don't think he means to do this. It loops over the defender. Right place, right time, as he seems to be every week. Jude Bellingham there to put it between Ter Stegen's legs. 2-1, they win the Clasico away. As someone who's probably has more knowledge about Bellingham than certainly me, at least from like his time at Birmingham City, and probably had to pay attention to him with Dortmund with the national team. How are you kind of interpreting the Jude Bellingham-ness that we're going through right now? Because it seems unsustainable to score 13 goals in 13 games for a central midfielder. But and this isn't his reputation either. But how are you kind of interpreting and digesting all of this?
It's joyous. It's delightful. Right? I tweeted this morning. I'm watching this like a proud uncle going, look, he's a man now. He's phenomenal. He's tremendous. He is playing at the top of this 4-4-2 diamond that Ancelotti's playing, but what really happens is the front two, you know, Rodrigo and Vinicius Junior, they split, and then Bellingham pops up for these late arrivals in the box, and he's basically the striker in a 4-3-3 because he just drives from these deeper positions. And you're right, Real Madrid were not good in that Clasico. Gavi did a real number on Bellingham, and Bellingham was barely getting a sniff, but for some reason, I don't know what he's putting in his water bottle, I don't know what script writer's in charge of this, I don't know what Tebas and Flo Perez are doing behind the scenes, but everything Jude Bellingham touches right now turns to gold, and that goal, the first one, is phenomenal. You could hit that ball 100 times and I don't think he'd score that more than 10 again, and that's a compliment. In that most people would perhaps only score that one more time, but I think Bellingham could score a couple more. And it goes in.
I didn't know he had like the power shot. I didn't know he had that one. Because all of these have been perfect run into the box, latching onto either a goalkeeper spill or like a 1-2. Like there hasn't been any sign, at least at Madrid. I don't know the type of goals he scored for England and Dortmund and Birmingham. But there hasn't been any sign that, oh, I can hit 30 yarders too.
No, but there he goes. when you're in good form like this, why not? And I've said this before, that every now and again, there's like a level of confidence a football player gets where they basically unlock first touch. Or like a hyped up first touch where they go.
It's like pro clubs.
Yeah, right. You know, it used to be and I'm sure we've all had this where for some reason it all clicks and you just start playing out your mind. Where normally it takes you 4 touches to control the ball, but now it's only taking 2. And Bellingham is in this fantastic realm. You also have the opposite where you're playing terribly and it normally takes you 2 touches to control the ball and it's going to start taking you 6. And yeah, you know, that goes in, and then the second chance, he's sniffing these things out like a veteran number nine. He's playing like Benzema did. And I'm talking late 20s, early 30s Benzema. This is what Bellingham is doing. And let's be really real. He wasn't having a great game. Gavi really got into him. But he scored twice. And what I really liked is after the first goal, there's a little bit where Rudiger sort of slaps him and goes, again, do the celebration again. Because are you not entertained? He's tremendous. At some point, his goal scoring form is going to cool off, right? We all talk about XG samples and blah, 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 and it'll tail off. But for now, Jude Bellingham is playing like one of the best football players on the planet. And he's doing it as a midfielder / striker. At some point in time, Real Madrid will go out and buy a striker for loads of money, and Bellingham will play more like an attacking midfielder. But I mean, tremendous, tremendous.
Two things. Number one, he needs a better celebration than just holding his arms out. I don't like it. Let's come up with something better. I don't know what, but it's stupid. I don't like it. It's not stupid. It's just lazy.
Would you like to hear a theory?
Sure.
I think that a number of goal celebrations now from players are being kept deliberately simple because they can be more easily copied by children and therefore help play into building your brand. Right? So no one's going to be able to do the multiple backflips of Obafemi Martins, but simply pointing to your temple like Marcus Rashford did, very, very effective. Now you're playing the new EAFC game or however you want to call it. When Rashford scores, he does that. That took a season to become a thing.
What's the sun thing with the camera and the triangle?
If you have a really simple, if you make a goal celebration simple enough that a child can replicate it, you will become, it will spread a lot easier. You know, Cristiano Ronaldo didn't score too many goals in his final season at Manchester United, but that old man falling asleep celebration has gone triple platinum.
That was good. But see, that's fun.
So the interesting
that's motion. And that's a complete tangent. Let me not. But that's a fun celebration. That's an iconic celebration. Like you jump, you turn in the air, and you go like with your arms down. Like that's fun. Just standing there with your arms out, like, hey, like it's me. Like I feel like it lets me know that I think he's even doing things that he's not expecting. It's a celebration of somebody who's like, am I really doing this?
So what I really like about the celebration is the very slow, almost tiptoe before he puts his arms out. So he doesn't run and do it. He sort of like slows down and he's like, 1, 2, 3, 4.
5, 6.
Yeah, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And I'm like, yeah, it's a very, are you not entertained? Look, I've been doing it at home. And I'm sure if I was a school teacher and I was watching the playground football at lunchtime, that there'd be 4 or 5 kids doing it already. Like, Bellingham's a superstar. Good for him.
This is, Mudrik did that after his fake cross shot. With his arms out. Yeah, but he didn't mean it. So that's my kind of. Also, Wayne Rooney, the bicycle kick.
Yep.
Against City, where the ball came really off his shin. But it was a great goal. He did
I'm not gonna argue.
I think Rooney's one was different.
Rooney's one was different because he turned his back to the crowd and he did it very much as an embrace me. And that's when Nani goes to hug him. True. Whereas Jude's one is very much to the crowd and very much, are you not entertained?
I think your theory might have some weight. It's interesting to consider anyway. Even the Lukaku one, I don't like the one where he hushes and salutes.
Yeah, I don't get that one. That's too many ingredients for me.
Yeah, it's too much hand and face. But either way, I think this is interesting. I'll take your tactical point. Is what Ancelotti is doing with Vinicius and Rodrigo? Obviously, it facilitates goals for Jude Bellingham. That's clear.
Mm-hmm.
But the manner in which Vinicius and Rodrigo are being deployed diminishes what they're capable of doing, because maybe just it's 13 games into the season, 14 games into the season. Maybe they haven't had enough time to really gel and figure out their positions, but they've been used to playing, especially Vinicius, with a number nine, a focal point, Benzema. Mm. You could, for 3-4 years, you could see Benzema kind of teaching and giving Vinicius information, almost like a cheat sheet, like put the ball here, run here, you do this. Like, he was very frustrated the first 2-3 seasons. And then Vinicius, or the maybe the first season or two, and then it clicked for Vinicius. And you could see him playing with Benzema. Their link up was really good. They had a good understanding. But once you remove that focal point, Vinicius is kind of left on his own. And I don't think that's good for his game. And if these goals dry up for Bellingham, maybe they won't. Maybe the way that they play, it will just facilitate some sort of number nine, like false nine, attacking eight, whatever the numbers are, to score goals for the breadth of the season. But I would think this is unsustainable. Mm-hmm. And it's not as if they're winning 5-0, 4-0, 3-1, 4. Like, they're not winning big. He's getting these goals late in games. There's a without those goals, there's a story of Real Madrid being 6th in the table, 5th in the table, 4th in the table, because the points that he's won them have been numerous. If that isn't sustainable in the same way, they need to figure out how to get the best from Vinicius without just by a striker. There has to be another way to do this. Maybe that diminishes Bellingham's output, but I think it could make their team better.
Now, when you're Real Madrid, just buy another striker. I know what you're saying. I know what you're saying. And if this was any other football club, I'd agree with you. But when you are Real Madrid, you know what the plan is. They're just going to buy a striker.
But who? Like, this season? Like, Osimhen is really the only striker out there.
No idea. No idea. No idea this season. When I say this season, I'm talking about the summer. I can't see Real Madrid.
Yeah, I can't see Real Madrid spending 100 million in the summer for a striker. I don't see that. So,
Ivan Toney's available. That's not a joke about Ivan Toney's quality. That's a joke about, I find it funny if Ivan Toney ended up at Real Madrid. Not because I don't think he's good enough, but because, I mean, Ivan Toney would fit in quite well at Real Madrid and what they want to do. But I can't see him there. And that's
if,
what I'm laughing.
But then, like, if I were Perez, how big an upgrade is Toney on Yosulu? We might as well just leave
a
it
lot.
For the.
Come
for
on, the, come on, man.
I don't
be
know.
Serious?
Like, no, Yosulu's not bad. He's just not like.
I'm not saying Yosulu is bad.
He's
I'm
just not Raul or Cristiano or one of those. So, either way, I just find it interesting the dynamics of how the tactical setup of a team can make one position or one set of players look worse than they have been, but how that can increase the output from a different position. So again, let's say Bellingham, knock on wood, he gets a knock somewhere. Like, the international break comes up, England plays somebody, and he gets a knock and he's out for 2-3 weeks. And that's 2-4 games of the season. Who knows? Who's the midfielder in that position that's going to come in and score the same goals, that's going to make the same runs? I don't think they have another player like him.
They won't do that. And again, this is Ancelotti. Ancelotti would find something else. Mm. You know, did anyone think Camavinga would play this many games at left back?
No.
No, but there you
By
go.
By the way, when he came in, he changed the game. Camavinga. Camavinga at left back. Modric, whatever he can give you still. It was good to see.
It was a fine classical. I just wish it was available to watch in a legal fashion to those in England.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Let's talk about United. Mm-hmm. We were going to do this regardless of your appearance today. So Actually, let's talk about City. I feel like let's just talk about the derby. Talking about United is perhaps 2 points.
You're going to put me in a torture rack, aren't you? Why are you doing this to me? Nothing.
Where would you start out, I guess? I don't even need to really speak. But the Manchester derby, go. Coin in the jukebox.
Manchester City are the current treble winners, one of the best teams in Europe. Oh, the current treble winners, they just won the best team award at the Ballon d'Or. They are the favorites to retain the Champions League. They're favorites to win the Premier League. And Manchester United are a long way off that standard, right? This is really concerning if you're a Man United fan. I saw that lineup and went, what's Ten Hag doing? Did he forget he bought Mason Mount? Because this is supposed to be the game that Mount is here for. And then you're watching this team going, what is the plan? And you're seeing, I think, a lot of United fans going, what is the plan? A lot of United fans are going, Ten Hag isn't all we cracked up to be. This might be worse than Ole Gunnar Solskjaer. I can't believe we've got, you know, another dud manager. Bing, bang, bang, boom. Couple things stood out for me in that game. One, the game plan seemed to be entirely based around... So first half game plan seemed to be 4-4-2 diamond. Scott McTominay is the 10. And you're going, all right, weird. You spent 330 million on players in two summer windows, and yet in the biggest game of your season against Manchester City at home, your game plan is centered around getting a player you nearly sold to West Ham to attack the box late. Fine. First half plan actually, but wasn't too bad. You know, they went to jump early on the left hand side, really trouble Julian Alvarez, and they were quite compact when they were off the ball, which is what you want to do. When you're playing against Manchester City, as teams like Brentford have shown, you defend in a really, really compact shape. And when you break, you break quickly. The thing is, United, while the compact shape was okay, when they broke with two players, you know, one or two players, when you should be breaking with like four running at pace. And they didn't run at anywhere near enough pace. So that was disappointing. Second half plan, he takes off Amrabat, he puts on Mason Mount, and you're going, all right, you're playing Manchester City with no defensive midfielder. Are you okay? So City did what City did. Bernardo Silva was amazing. Rodri was amazing. That's the best I've seen Jack Grealish play this season. And I think Grealish will probably take that starting position back off Doku. I saw Antony should have got sent off. And honestly, I've had it up to here with him.
Was it handbags? Is that what you guys say? The handbags?
Yeah, handbags.
Where they were going to fight. Yeah, or
just like incredibly petulant. Doku's playing really good football, and he goes past you, so you just petulantly try and hack.
Were you in the stadium? Were you?
I was in the stadium. Doku stops playing football and wags his finger at Antony, saying, "What are you playing at?" And then Antony tries to start beef, like. No,
so my
Antony,
my,
you're in the wrong
my question
here.
Would be, was there a positive response to Antony
no.
at least showing some level no. of aggression
no.
relative to the rest of the team, or were no. fans sick of him too?
Fans are sick of him. Multiple United fans have gone, what's the point? Or mentioned this fee, going, you know, £86 million on a wing who isn't quick and can't use his right foot. Right, what are we doing here? And that's what are we doing here? Is the wider sense of things at Manchester United? You know, Ten Hag gave a number of interviews after the game that just provoke more questions rather than give answers. So things are bad. Things are bad right now as a Man United fan. They're playing Newcastle. They're playing Newcastle on Wednesday, and then they're playing Fulham on Sunday, and then they're away against Copenhagen, and they need to win all those games. This November, Manchester United could be out of the League Cup, they could be out of the Champions League group stages, and they could be, the worst case scenario is United lose to Newcastle, out of the League Cup. You lose to Copenhagen, or you don't get the results you need against Copenhagen, and you're out of the Champions League group stages. And then you continue to have poor form in the Premier League, and then you're way out of the Champions League qualification race. Now, I'm saying this is a worst case scenario, but you're looking at the way Manchester United are playing, and there's very little discernible patterns of play. And you're going, yeah, Manchester United should be beating a team. Manchester United playing Luton on the 11th of November. United should be beating Luton. And yet, if you ask a United fan right now, what's the score against you versus a Luton team that has a fraction of your money? They'll go, eh, might scrape a win. The confidence is very low.
Yeah, it just sounds bad, bro.
Thanks, man.
Oh, yeah, I was going to see if I could come up with something, but nah. It doesn't sound great at all. I think, well, the only positive news is that Onana did not look bad in the game.
He was the best player, honestly.
I would say so. He made a couple saves where I was just like, I went, wow. And this is off the back of him saving the penalty. So I'm not a Manchester United fan. But in the game against Copenhagen, when they got the penalty and like the last kick of the game virtually, I was like, bro, please save this. Like it would have been great for narratives for Manchester United to miss out on, you know, or just like to crash out of the Champions League. Like that would have been fun, I'm sure, for memes. But I was like, bro, please save this, because you need this for your United career, for people to feel good about you. Like you need a moment, so please give them a moment. And he came up with a save. I mean, the penalty wasn't that great from, I think, Larsson's son, if I have it right.
It was Henrik Larsson's son. Yep.
Yeah. Whose first name I don't know. He's just Henrik Larsson's son. But yeah, like I was like, cool. So he has a moment, and then he carried at least some of that good feeling, I suppose. Like the save on Haaland, the first one where Haaland tries to head it, I think, down and across, and he got it wrong, and Onana was just there. I was like, whoa, like he got it. But there were too many chances from City for any keeper really to have a chance to stop them going in. So I'm sorry. When you have Maguire and Johnny Evans as your starting center back partnership, I'm not expecting much from the game, honestly. So it's one of those things of like, yeah, they spent a lot of money, but if you consider Varane out, Martinez out, Shaw out, Wamba's, like your preferred starting back four is not playing. What should we be expecting against Manchester City? A win?
Now, Rafael Varane was on the bench, and Ten Hag was asked, why is Rafael Varane on the bench? And Ten Hag said it was tactical reasons.
Well, damn. Well, I don't know.
Now, he went on to explain it, saying if you played Harry Maguire left centre back and Rafael Varane right centre back, then you just have to kick it long because City's press is so aggressive. Now, and he says he truly believes Maguire's better at a right centre back. So he wanted a left centre back to come in. And the best left centre back or someone capable of playing the ball is 35-year-old Johnny Evans, who was signed in the short term. Let me double check this.
Yeah,
35-year-old. You know, and the best choice at left centre back at the moment is 35-year-old Johnny.
He's going to be 36.
Is 35-year-old Johnny Evans, who signed a short-term contract. Contract during preseason and was being paid minimum wage before he signed a proper contract before the season started.
He was just there to train, right? He was just there to train.
He was on minimum wage.
Because maybe he might go to a championship club. And
he was on minimum wage, right? He was on less than £10 an hour. It was basically on £10.40 an hour to train at Manchester United. And the idea was he was going to be a good influence to the academy children as he was training, and then injury crisis happened, he stays, and then on top of that injury crisis exacerbates and Manchester United in possession plan against Manchester City in one of the biggest games of the season is play the ball through Johnny Evans more than anyone else. Now is that's not Johnny Evans
to his credit,
that's not Johnny Evans'
fault. I do remember one moment where he was under pressure. And he gave a little shimmy with the ball one way, took it back to the corner flag, I think, and then was able to get rid of it with his left, I'm sure of it. But that being said, if the tactical plan doesn't include Varane, Yeah. What are the tactics you're employing? That's my question. And
a very, very good question.
And this is a point I've wondered about for like the last 3-4 years. I'm wondering, as somebody who's observing this person for 3-4 months, do you have an idea? The functionality of Mason Mount is blank. Like, what does he do for this team?
That's a really good question that I'm going to spend a lot of November trying to find out. That's all I can say. That's all I can say right now.
And I guess he's been injured, so maybe that's not a fair question right now.
I am genuinely baffled why you would spend $55 million plus an extra $5 million if certain conditions are met on Mason Mount, why you would spend so much time calling him a dynamic player, calling him a complete midfielder, if in a game such as this, you don't start him. And it's not that this is the one-off game that he didn't start him. He's not started in a number of games. And this is another problem in that Ten Hag hasn't been the best communicator recently. He's got a very circuitous way of speaking, even at the best of times. And when he does give explanations, sometimes they don't quite add up and you can't quite tell, are you doing this because you don't want to explain it, or are you doing this because you're poorly explaining what you're trying to do?
One, is there any positive silver lining, like Højlund maybe, or
Højlund is good, and it really looks as if Højlund will be a player. I'm watching PSG games. I'm watching Randall Kolo Muani. I'm watching Gonçalo Ramos, and they're being fine. And I'm saying I'm at this point in time happier to have Højlund. The problem is, Højlund has a back issue and can't play 90 minutes. It's unknown whether or not he can play 90 minutes. So Ten Hag keeps taking him off.
Is this a chronic thing? Or is this something
He has a back issue. He sustained a back injury in preseason when he was at Atalanta. So when he signed for United, he was injured. Right? Now you go, why did Manchester United spend $70 million on a player with 9 Serie A goals who was injured when they could have got someone else? That's a far more complicated question.
Carl, we haven't talked since the ownership thing. What's going on with that?
We're just doing a Man United podcast today, huh?
last thing. I thought the last thing was the last thing, but this is the last thing. Okay. What's up with the owners?
One thing we'll talk about quickly is Højlund was taken off in the 70-something minute. And one thing I'll say is when Højlund was taken off, Ten Hag got booed because United fans were going, you're 2-0 down and you've just taken off your best chance of a goal. Højlund still hasn't scored a Premier League goal yet. He's got 3 in the Champions League. And United fans are getting annoyed because they want to see more of Højlund. They want him to play. Ten Hag keeps saying, I have to take him off because I have to keep him fit. I have to make sure he doesn't get injured. I have to... You know, I have to keep him tip top, because if he gets injured, then the only other striker, number 9, is Martial, and Martial can't sprint anymore. Which says a lot, right? You've got one of the most expensive squads in world football, and you've only got one number 9 who can sprint.
Damn.
Now, ownership situation. Ask your question again, please.
No, you think I want to talk about Chelsea? Like, this is before. My question was just more because we haven't spoken since, I don't know, it's maybe been a month or two, like on wax. So there was a bid from the Qataris that fell through. And to my knowledge, Radcliffe's group is going to be purchasing Manchester United in installments. Or at least there's a road to that. So is that basically the narrative?
So I'd say towards the middle of September, it became more likely that a bid from Sir Jim Radcliffe and Ineos, or no, so let me rephrase that. A bid from Sir Jim Radcliffe, who is in charge of Ineos, who is also the owner of Nice in France, who is also in charge of, who also owns a cycling team. So Jim Radcliffe has made a bid for 25% of Manchester United in a deal that is worth, depending on who you talk to, 1.3 or 1.8 billion. Ooh. Now, this bid for 25 million for 25 this bid for 25% of the club comes with the roadmap, like you said, is a good way of describing it, roadmap to eventually take over 100% of the club sometime down the line. We also, it's become, as reported on The Athletic, as reported on a number of outlets, has become clear that in this wanting 25% of Manchester United, so Jim Radcliffe has made it clear he wants control of the footballing side of Manchester United as well. And it appears as if the Glazer family are amenable to that proposition. Mm. Now, this is a fun question that was posed by Adam Crafton. If you own 75% of a football club, but you're letting someone else run the footballing side of it, what does that say about you as an owner?
You're just here for the money.
Thank you very much for answering that question.
Oh, was that not rhetorical? Sorry.
No, it was a rhetorical one. And because you're based in North America, you can't get sued for saying that.
It would seem as if money is your primary interest.
There you go. There we go. You have to say allegedly, fam. So that's that. Now I've heard, I've had many questions from different outlets across the world. Can you come in? When's this deal going to be approved? When's it going to happen? Is this going to be such a reckless first game? And we don't know. As Andy Mitten from United We Stand says, the Glazers are known for doing things at a glacial pace. Things will happen on the Glazers timescale because the Glazers are interested in the Glazers and they're not so much interested in Manchester United. So it is pretty likely that at some point Sir Jim Redcliffe will own 25% of Manchester United and might have a say on the footballing infrastructure of the football club. That's a weird sentence. Sorry about that. When that happened, I don't know.
You know who? Okay, it's bad for United. It's very bad. It's very, very bad. It's very bad. We've discussed.
But you know who's also bad for? Chelsea Football Club.
I was going to say Ajax, but okay. What? Okay, now you can ask me Chelsea questions.
So, and I watched this Brentford game.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't look that bad, but also I don't see how you score goals.
I need to look at the lineup. I need to remind myself. I think I've watched too much football this week, and this is the first game. So I'm looking at the team.
So
okay, this is okay. No, okay. The major problem.
Have you got the lineup in front of you? Have you got the lineup in front
of
you?
Yes. Do you, okay, do you want me to read it?
Stop. Don't read it out for me. I'm gonna just.
All right.
So my friend Ryan Hun from the Stadio podcast plays this game now, where he goes, Chelsea played a game in Premier League football. Guess the back four.
Okay.
And the idea is because they chop and change so much, it's very hard to. So I'm gonna say, and this is a game I watched. I watched this. Okay, Marco Cucurella played left back.
Ding, 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 ding.
Axel played left centre back.
No.
Oh. All right, Thiago Silva was also playing.
Yes.
I'm going to say Thiago Silva, right centre back.
Correct.
I'm going to say Colwell, left centre back.
There you go.
And then Malo Gusto, right back.
No.
Oh! Oh, Gusto's still suspended, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Who was your right back?
This was going to be part of the problem that I was going to deduce here in a second. It was De Sassi.
Okay. Okay. There you
go. So, basically the right-hand side was non-existent against Brentford. So, even though it looked good, most of the attacking came from Cucurella, Caicedo, and Sterling's side, and Palmer would sometimes drift to create an overload. But on the other side, you have Madueke, who's playing, maybe this is his first start of the season. Mm-hmm. He's being supported, in air quotes, by De Sassi, who's allergic to crossing the halfway line.
Supported in air
quotes. And then Conor Gallagher is your center mid on that side. So not the most creative. And if you're Palmer, naturally you're going to go to where the better footballers are, which is on the left. Jackson is raw. not in a footballing sense, but in like a striking sense. So there are times and there are things that he does during the game where I'm like, there's a good footballer there. Like his technique, his vision, his eye for like back heels and spatial awareness is decent. But the striking instincts of being in the right place at the right time, which center back to pick on, which run to make, which channel to choose, staying onside, is Sterling going to go for, is he going to cut it back or is he going to put it, is he going to flash it across? There are just little things where you're like, these could be polished. The problem is Chelsea don't have time really and never have had time for a striker to polish themselves in the team. Mm-hmm. They buy finished articles. Now, perhaps this has changed with the new directive of Clear Lake. But when you think of Chelsea's last two, three great strikers, I can't put Giroud in there, but I'll put him in there. So four. Giroud, senior, polished, done product. Diego Costa, senior, polished, finished product. Drogba came at 26. Great season at Marseille. Senior, polished, finished product, damn near. And then the one before, Jimmy Floyd Hasselbaink. Senior, polished. Like, that's the trajectory of what you're trying to... Even, I'll throw Anelka in there. Very polished, very seasoned. That's Chelsea's DNA, is to go for... But DNA has changed. It doesn't even mean the same thing anymore when you have a new ownership group, which I'm sure you'll be exposed to quite soon. Yeah. But what Chelsea have been are not what they are. So this creates a problem, I think, especially in the fan base and people who are used to watching a particular thing. It's like, well, we don't have time to see if Jackson can be good. We don't have time to see if you name it can be good. We need somebody now. So this creates a problem because there's a player there in Jackson. But when you correctly deduce that goal scoring is a problem, the fans, and I think rightly so, will want somebody that we need somebody to finish at any little scrap of a chance. They have to be able to finish it. Any little opening, you need to finish it, because if you don't, we're not going to create anything else for the next 20, 30 minutes. So, and Jackson isn't that type of player. He's more a player that will help you create a goal at the moment rather than he will help you write the sentence, but he's not the period or the punctuation on it. This then puts a lot of pressure on the impending return of Nkunku, who people seem to think is going to have some Jude Bellingham like revelation and he's Jesus Christ's second coming and he's going to be scoring a goal a game. I don't know if that's the type of player Nkunku is, because I feel like he's another one who's going to want to play football, not necessarily be the punctuation.
So is Nkunku going to be your 10, or is Nkunku going to be your number 9 now?
I think they're going to play him as a number 9 because Palmer has taken over 10. The interesting thing about Palmer,
very, very nice.
And this is something that I wanted to talk with Half Hope about. Is Palmer that good, or have we just been so deprived of an actual footballer in that position that Palmer looks like he's good? This is something that I think Chilwell benefited from. Chelsea fans were so used to watching Marcus Alonso run in mud that anybody who was a bit quick and could actually defend their position, Chilwell is like he was the next coming of Ashley Cole. I wonder if you get used to watching Mason Mount and Havertz in that position, somebody who can actually see a through ball and do a step over. Oh wow! Let's give him the keys to the kingdom. Let's give him the keys to the kingdom. But
that Mason Mount line, that hurt me.
Jury's out. Jury's out on Cole Palmer. I don't know personally. Like, he's good, and I think he's a squad player. But I don't know if you could just I don't think he's good enough to drive a team.
Again, I watched that Brentford game, and he has that, you know, close control dribbling, and he has that thing where it looks like he's gliding across the pitch. Now, many, many great football players look like they glide across the field. So it becomes very easy to say, oh, he glides, therefore he must be great. I'm not sure if Cole is going to be great, but he definitely has the glide. And he was 45 million.
For sure. Like
For 45 million for a homegrown.
It's a good purchase. It's a good purchase. Yes.
Now, I don't. The plan should be Cole Palmer doesn't have to be your best player. The plan should just be he is a very top-end facilitator for others. Now, those others should be Nkunku. They should be Caicedo and Enzo behind you. They should be, whoever Sterling. You want to play on the Sterling, if you want to play Sterling on the left and you want to put one more on the right hand side. I'm looking at Chelsea going, this should be more fun.
Right? It should be. It should be. But do you have fun in a process? Like, is the process fun?
No, let me redo that. This should be fun. Now, that is, I think that's weird for a Chelsea group fan base that has been weaned on, it's fun because you're winning loads of trophies, and it's not fun because you're not winning trophies. How do you find that's that bit rub. Where you're not winning trophies, but it's still fun?
That doesn't exist in West London, at least the blue part. That doesn't exist there. Perhaps it exists in Brentford, maybe Fulham, but not Chelsea. Like, fun, the fun is winning. The fun isn't watching players. Like, for me, it's fun in some instances, seeing things that, like, what Jackson are doing, what Drake's doing. It's funny, actually. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, like, not satirical, but like Schadenfreude, like fun from the misery of others. Fuck. But I don't think for the Chelsea fan base for the last 20 years that's been accustomed to winning, and we derive our meaning and our identity from lifting trophies, losing to Brentford, no matter how fun it should be and could be and sometimes is, like Sanchez chasing Maupay, I think, that was fun. Like him not being able to tackle him, that was fun. But not within the context of Chelsea are a team that's built to win. But it's a, as I said, it's a completely different DNA that's happening at the moment. So we can leave England there. Arsenal, shout out Arsenal, shout out Tottenham, shout out Liverpool. We'll come back next week.
Look, we're more than a quarter of the Premier League season done. Everyone's played 10 games, and the Premier League table looks like, this is the sound of me typing, top of the table Spurs.
Tottenham top. Yeah.
Tottenham top. That's on 20. Weird for you. I want to say 26.
24? I want to say 24.
This is the top of my head. Sorry, my computer is on its last legs. I simply need to buy a new one.
Do you know what? M3 just got released last night. 26, you were correct. 26 points.
26 points for Tottenham. Arsenal second, 24. Man City third with 24. Liverpool fourth, 23. Villa are fifth, 22. Aston Villa's got a very favourable run of fixtures coming up. Newcastle are sixth. 17, followed by Brighton on 17. And there's Manchester United on 15 points in 8th. West Ham, 14 points. Brentford, 13 points. And Chelsea have 12 points and an 11th. Very, very quick question here, Dan. Top 5 is Spurs, Arsenal, Man City, Liverpool, Aston Villa. Is anyone going to break into that top 5 come the end of the season?
The only question mark is Villa. Like, can Unai Emery sustain whatever they're doing there? I saw a graphic the other day that said, since Unai Emery has been in the Premier League, Aston Villa are fourth in that league table.
Yep.
I think they played 36 games or somewhere there, and they're fourth. So whatever he's doing with, you know, Ollie Watkins and Matty Cash and all those dudes, like, it must be working to an extent. But I do think I say that Newcastle, maybe the Champions League is it's a bridge too far for them to compete on that many fronts. Manchester United are Manchester United, so they could get into a winning run basically at any time because they have the talent in their team. It's just, will it ever click? Brighton, so you know what? I think that top five will stay the top five. But I don't think it will fluctuate within the course of the season. But by the end, those will be the five.
Before the season started, I said City top, Arsenal second, Liverpool third. I said a gap between Liverpool and Arsenal be really, really thin. I said Manchester United fourth, and I said Chelsea fifth. I'm now going to give you a rebooted one, which is Manchester City one, Arsenal two, Liverpool three. Spurs 4.
Damn.
Villa 5th. And Newcastle in 6th. It's a great time to be a Spurs fan. However, I think goals are a problem. And Richarlison, while I like him a lot, I don't think he's on the same level as Son and Madison, which is a shame.
Yeah.
One fun thing, if you're a Spurs fan, is, you know, at a time when everyone's spending loads of money on defensive midfielders, you've got Bentancur and you've got Bissouma. So you should be pretty sweet there. Arsenal are good. I don't think they're going to regress. I think Declan Rice is phenomenal. And I think the Kai Havertz experiment is being quietly shuffled. So that's fine. City is City. Fantastic. Liverpool are going to be the great entertainers and great goal scorers in the league. So there you have it. And I think Aston Villa, as long as Ollie Watkins stays fit, they should have a little bit more than Newcastle.
Last thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I watched two Serie A games. I watched Napoli against Milan.
Watched
Roma against Inter. So I watched those.
Uh-huh.
But in the time we have left, I think we should probably talk about Ajax.
Sure.
So again, I watched PSV. Mm-hmm. They were up 1-0. They had a chance to go up 2-0 with Broby. He misses 2-0. PSV then score, I want to say they score 2-1. And then, was it 2-2? Or because Broby scored one somewhere in there.
Yeah.
So it was 1-1, then it went to 2-1. And then it devolved from there.
Yep.
So, I guess, do they have you traveling back and forth to Netherlands these days?
We can't afford it at the moment, but I'm talking to you right now. I've got my laptop. I'm talking to you, and then behind I've got my desktop screen, and I've got some Ajax games queued up to watch. And they're bad. They're really bad. Opta analyst did a fantastic piece on the 27th saying Ajax are in 17th place, but their underlying numbers suggest they should be 18th place. Bear in mind, the Eredivisie is 18 teams.
No, so, they're 18th, bro.
And then they lost. And now they lost the PSV, so then they went to 18th. They're playing midweek. Oh, they're playing midweek? 2nd of November. They're playing against a team beginning with V. My apologies. Which is the team above them in 17th. So they might get out of the relegation zone. Voldenham. Thank you. Yes. Now they might get out of the relegation zone by the next time I appear on this podcast.
How do you say the next one, Carl? So that's like November 5th, they play a club named H? Herendeven?
Oh.
Herendeven?
Yeah. You got it.
You don't sound confident.
You got it, bro.
What an ugly language.
And, you know, Maurice Stein got sacked after the defeat against FC Utrecht. So the Utrecht game was phenomenal, compliment and derogatory. They went 2-0 up away from home against Utrecht. No, they went 2-0 down against FC Utrecht away from home. Fought, scratched and clawed their way and got to 3-2. Then Utrecht equalized to make it 3-3. Then fans threw loads of cups and whatever to temporarily pause the game, which is something that's happening a lot in Dutch football at the moment. When that there is a new ruling that if fan trouble goes on for too much, the game can be suspended and possibly abandoned.
That happened against Feyenoord, right?
This happened against Feyenoord. Yeah. And it happened after another game where I think David Klaassen got... It happened in a game last season where David Klaassen got struck in the back of the head with a lighter. So games can get suspended, if not abandoned, due to fan trouble. And now you're getting to this weird, unfortunate point where Ajax fans are getting so angry at the fact their team is doing so badly. They're going, let's just get this game abandoned and throw stuff on the field. So the game gets temporarily suspended at 3-3 because loads of fans are throwing plastic cups on the field. Get suspended, and then they bring the game back, and then Utrecht score a winner to make it 4-3. And you're just like, this is bad. Very, very quickly, why are they bad? They are playing football in right angles. So does that make sense if I say that?
It's too straight? Is that what you mean?
It's you know, a player gets into possession and he has two options when that's pass in right angles, pass sideways or pass down the line in front of you. And they, unfortunately, they're trying to play in the Ajax way, but the players they currently have aren't, I mean, their centre-backs in particular, aren't the most comfortable in possession, which...
Mm. Can I ask a question that maybe you don't have an answer to?
Sure.
Does this stem from Van der Sar and his injury?
No.
or his okay.
So I did a previous piece on The Athletic with Simon Hughes. You can read that now. And the big problem was so Mark Overmars was sacked just under 2 years ago. So he was the director of football, and he was sacked for sexual misconduct. He was essentially taking photographs of his genitalia and sending them to members of staff, and among other things. So Van der Sar sacked him, but didn't hire a replacement for something like just over a year. So Overmars's job gets compartmentalized, gets split between a number of people, including Klaas-Jan Huntelaar and Jerry Hamstra. These individuals are... So in the initial months where Overmars is gone, Ajax fans are going, oh man, it should have been Overmars. Overmars was the key, because Overmars also enabled Ten Hag to do stuff, and Overmars was a genius. And what has become known now is that Overmars left no handover notes, right? There is no... Basically, Overmars was running the football club from his mobile phone and via WhatsApp. If Overmars wanted to buy a player, he'd text them. If Overmars wanted to make the deal done, he'd go via WhatsApp and then text them the number. And it was all done via WhatsApp. So when he was removed, there's just no notes. So they have these 50 months with no director of football. Then they eventually hire in Sven Mislintat, who used to work at Arsenal. Dortmund as well. Now, Mr. Tat did the big thing of saying, we are going to modernize Ajax. We're going to be data-led. We're going to hire new modern jobs and be more about data. And we're going to make a big thing on bringing in... We're going to lower the wage bill, make the team younger again, and then we'll go again. So 12 players came in. 12 players came in, and I want to say maybe close to 10, maybe 11 players got sold. So... I'd say 150 million was raised in player sales, but also those departures are the likes of Dusan Tadic, who went on a free. He was your club captain. Mohamed Kudus went off to West Ham. He's your best attacking player. So they lost loads of quality, and the players they did bring in were all either really, really young or statistical favorites, you know, guys who do really good in FM. And then on top of that, Mislintat hired Maurice Stijn, who got a Sparta Rotterdam to their best league finish last season in 27 years. So, and he's our new manager. He comes out really good in the data. So it's a really, really young team with a manager who has no like real links to Ajax. And then this is what you have. And we're talking right now at a time where, I mean, Ajax are bottom, Lyon are bottom of...
Lyon Marseille got called off because
someone dashed the Marseille bricks at the team coach.
The Marseille ultras threw a brick, and then they threw a brick, broke a window, hit Fabio Grosso, whose face was bloodied, and then because the window was broken, they were able to throw more things inside the bus.
So Lyon are also a mess, and as I found out today, FC Bar, depending on your pronunciation,
really.
They are bottom of the Swiss table.
Oh man!
They scored no goals in the month of October, so there's no goal a month competition there.
Wow, what a depressing episode! Except for Jude Bellingham, and I guess Messi, if you care about that.
Yeah. Anyway,
Chelsea are bad. United are bad. Ajax are bad. Basel's bad. Lyon's bad. Everybody's bad. What's going on? Our childhood is being eroded. Pretty much all the teams that were good when we were kids are no longer firing. Although Arsenal. Anyway, I need to go. So this has been the Talking Tactics podcast. We do this every Tuesday. You guys hear it on Wednesday, whenever. Daniel, Carl, where can people find your work?
You can find my work over at The Athletic. You can find my videos on TIFO IRL as well.
Yeah, Talking Tactics podcast. Sometimes funny, sometimes serious.
Always football.
We try. See you guys next week. Peace.
Sports Social Podcast Network.